You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist, coming to you from an undisclosed, very rural location in western Pennsylvania. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today's date is the evening of the 21st of December, 2024. Many of you have noticed that I've not been around for the last couple of weeks. I've mentioned that I moved. The point being to get out of the city and go to what amounts to the middle of nowhere to live a more contemplative and, frankly, more rational life. The move itself took a lot longer than I expected. The moving company that we contracted with showed up and just frankly didn't feel like doing the work. They were going to pack and do the heavy lifting. My wife is not in the physical condition to do that kind of thing. And they walked out on the job. I wasn't there at the time. So here we are. We have to be out at a certain time. And we have a whole, you know, home full of things. And I'm not even there. I'm waiting at the new place. So my wife, being the woman that she is, thought very quickly, gathered a few of the mentally ill people who she works with, explains her marrying me, and somehow, over the next 48 hours, we made this work. It was a move from hell. There is no purgatory with moves like this. My body is just a mess. It's getting a little bit better. But I lifted a tonnage that I was not expecting. And I was hurting for quite a while, and I still am. And only now, if you notice, last week I did my first Daily Nationalist back on the Syrian case. And as always, when I have a leave of absence, when I leave and something's going on, something tremendous happens in the news, and this was not an exception. That phenomenon got started in 1990. And the first Iraq war broke out, and I was on the high seas. And I do want to publicly say that my wife really is, despite her arthritis and everything else, an absolutely extraordinary woman. As a gift, she bought me new office furniture and put it together herself. I would rather have sex with Whoopi Goldberg than put together these you know, IKEA-style. Well, maybe not. That's a little extreme, but putting this stuff together is agony for me. And as always, I almost feel guilty marrying her because, you know, there's so few of her out there. And she takes care of me, and she has my back because this is all I do, 24 hours a day. And I also know that I could have contacted any one of you who live nearby, and you wouldn't have hesitated to come and help. And I had a few offers as this disaster unfolded, going on 3 weeks now. And this January 1st will be 35 years that I've been doing this sort of thing full time, whether it be as a student or as a professional. This is all I do. This is all I know how to do. And because of the support people like you, I'm able to do it outside of any institution that would put shackles on me. And that brings us to today's topic. You know, I deal with a lot of philosophers that get very little attention in the West and the English-speaking world, primarily because they are the antidote to the assumptions of the Enlightenment that we were all raised with. I mean, if you're raised in 20th century America or the EU, you're raised with a series of assumptions that becomes part of the firmware, really the hardware of your cognition. And it's extremely difficult to break out of it. And that's why dealing with this stuff, ontology, metaphysics, epistemology, which I dip in from time to time. Well, first of all, there's not a lot of people who can do it. Not a lot of people who know the language, at least basically like I do, that I could read most of it without too much agony and get through a lot of this stuff, because most of these people don't have a presence philosophically in the Western world, and for very good reason from the point of view of liberalism. Now, I can't remember if I've treated this guy before. I think I might have. And we're dealing today with the metaphysics and historiography of Alexei Losev, who lived a long life from 1893 to 1988, mostly within the confines of the Soviet Union. And he absolutely refused to leave. He did get sent to prison, a gulag camp for a while. I think they made him a night watchman at some point because his health couldn't handle it. He was a married man, but at some point he took secret monastic vows. But he made it a point that he was not going to leave Russia, regardless of the circumstances that he was forced to live under. And to put it as simply as I can, there's very little that's simple about this guy. His work was to try to kick out the jams that supported Soviet society, the same ones that support American society, without irritating the officials too much. And he failed to do that for the most part. And the only real controversy that he caused, he was an anti-Semite, which of course was illegal in the West, as it is in the old Soviet Union, claiming that he was a Black Hundred and a terrorist and everything else, and that going to the gulag was not enough for him. But really the only thing that Western intellectuals know about him is he's a Black Hundred member or something like that. The only thing that anyone really in the West cares about. Well, he certainly did believe Bolshevism was Jewish. You have to be illiterate or willfully ignorant not to realize that. But that's simply a statement of fact. Alexei Losev, I don't remember if I've dealt with him in terms of his history, his conception of myth, and his metaphysics. I've dealt with a number of these sorts of guys. They're all moving in the same direction, although in very different ways. And as I said before, to deal with this kind of thing, the point is to break the dependency that we all have to the basic assumptions, the Newtonian scientific assumptions of being raised in the Western world. And it's very difficult to break free of that. I turned a corner when I moved to Johns. I turned a corner maybe 10, 12 years ago, where I no longer thought in those terms. And that's a very difficult corner to turn, not just because it's hard to get there, but it's hard to live after that. The nonsensical conception of science, this very vulgar, you know, popular mechanics kind of mentality that exists in the West, as Alexander Dugin said recently, among other things, came from the rejection of Aristotle's causes. Three out of the four, anyway. We talked about this with E. Michael Jones and his blistering critique of Isaac Newton. I've always said that Thomas Hobbes, who was very similar in this respect, was the founder of at least intellectual modernity. But the only cause that remained was, in typical mechanical fashion, the efficient cause, the proximate cause of motion. So things in the universe no longer had a purpose. Ideas like the formal, the material, and certainly the final causes were removed. There was no internal purpose to anything. It had no, in other words, spiritual essence. Nominalism, of course, is the foundation for all of this. And really, the object that mechanics talk about isn't important. The only thing that exists is love and strife, atoms in the void, aimless motion and nothingness. There is no identities, which would be the formal cause. The total malleability of everything, the Darwinian idea, or the rejection of the material cause, and the ultimate goal of everything, of course, St. Augustine says that this is God himself, is removed. It is all aimless, and therefore, the only thing that matters is to be able to have the power to manipulate the system. It eliminates the purpose of any creation whatsoever. It removes, as Dugin says, it strips time of any orientation. The Hobbesian philosophy led to the collapse of the intellect. He cites Werner Heisenberg, well known for the quantum theory, that he stated that the classical science, which is what Losef spent most of his time dealing with, posited a world that was a meaningful whole. But in the modern world, it was fragmented. In fact, reduced to meaningless fragments. It was something to be conquered. Ultimately, something to be dominated. And ultimately, it comes from the Kabbalah and its manifestation, the various Masonic lodges, starting in the 18th century. It deprives, as I said many times concerning nominalism, it deprives any naturally occurring object, including human beings, of any meaning or purpose. The only thing that it recognizes is force. When you reject the purpose, or telos in Greek, of motion, to reject the idea that there's an inherent purpose to the motion of bodies, that means the will to power is all that remains. And it certainly suits people, as E. Michael Jones has told us, like William of Orange, who had no right to rule Britain. Of course, Isaac Newton was a supporter of the so-called Glorious Revolution. And it was a very convenient connection of physics to politics. Because there is no concept of throne, or even reason, or mankind, or rule, or justice. And there really is no foundation to criticize anything. It's this overall meaninglessness. But it's also, as I've said 100 times before, people like Eric Vogel and so many others, it's also the foundation of totalitarianism, where everything is mere cause and effect. The only cause is the efficient cause. Atoms in the void. Balls on the billiard table. But there is no such thing as liberalism or Darwinism or Marxism. And of course, they're all very similar. Without this ideology. And that's why the study of metaphysics, as difficult and sometimes as off-putting as it is, the metaphysics of the dissenters is essential and critical today. The assumptions of the Enlightenment, the basic Hobbesian, Newtonian, even Lockean ideology runs deep. This is how we were raised, even without anyone doing this purposefully. Being able to get behind these assumptions, not just intellectually, but even as a matter of instinct, is very difficult. And it's one of the reasons I talk about these guys. And Losef being one of the most interesting, however, one of the least accessible. He doesn't give many concessions to the non-specialist. Of course, Plato, more so than Aristotle, although, you know, the entire modern world had its foundation with the rejection of both Plato and Aristotle, but Aristotle in particular, because they were trying to overthrow the Scholastics after William of Ockham. the founder of at least modern nominalism. Of course, the postmodern world has gone beyond that. Now the individual, the particular, that doesn't exist anymore. But atoms in the void, as Locke would say, along with the empirical, or with empiricism as an ideology, inductive reasoning, in Lowell's mind, that has destroyed any foundation for morals. The minute you destroy any purposeful end inherent in, say, being a man, being the father of a family. Of course, in the modern and postmodern worlds, those are mere accidents. There can be no natural laws in the nominalist universe. Everything, then, is reduced to appearances. But the truth is that the intellect, as Aristotle would say, is the essence of man. That's our life function. But if we are rational, then we are also free. As I've said many times before, the two go together. Reason doesn't make any sense without free will. And free will certainly doesn't make any sense without reason. Instinctive drives, by definition, are non, I didn't say they're not irrational, they're non-rational. So the empirical mind can only see the world as, or knowledge as this accumulation of facts towards an end that's imposed from without. But rather, reason. Remember, I've made this distinction between reason and logic in the past. Reason, or nous, connected with the heart. The intellect is within the heart. Is far broader, more fundamental than logic. Logic just attaches means to ends. Now, of course, the word logic itself has a far broader meaning, but I'm using it to make a point here. What Losev says, reason, the essence of mankind, our ability to understand the spirit through our consciousness, which is not a physical thing, that's our war, our battle against chaos. But the process is in the creation of a self, a personality. These are historical objects. They are systemic objects. The self comes into existence through design. I find myself citing Heidegger more and more often, as Dugin himself does. The ideal of something and its presence create unity, create the object that we see in front of us. The object by itself is dead. It doesn't mean anything. We have to impose an idea on it. The identity of something that we come to know and the differences in attributes. That is to say, one man may be taller or shorter than another, darker or lighter than another. Identity and difference create the ideal. That's when the presence of something becomes an object that we can know. The idea and the identity create the content. Now, that's a lengthy way of talking about something that we dealt with Hegel in the past. And what it comes down to is identity, the object, of course, it never exists just as a blunt, brute thing. That doesn't exist. This was the foundation of Hegel's phenomenology, and it goes back to Plato. A never just equals A. The hypostasis in Losev is a symbol. We've talked about the nature of symbol. Losev was really born during the Russian Silver Age, the explosion of both religious and metaphysical speculation in Russia. Some of it very deviant, but much of it very interesting, at least. And part of this movement were the symbolists, who I always found intriguing, not specifically orthodox, but there's a lot we can learn. This explosion of anti-materialist and anti-socialist, or, you know, Marxian socialist ideas in both literature as well as in philosophy. The symbol is not something that opposes substance. We talk about something is symbolic. I've said this before. Something is symbolic, therefore we can ignore it. It doesn't have any substance. That's not the definition. We get the word synod, synthesis. All of these are connected with the word symbol. It's the form of something without any attribute. It's a reflection of its meaning and purpose, its inherent purpose. For any object that we symbolize, it's a structured idea. It reflects the complexity of something, its context, not to mention our own freedom, because we have free will through our own conscience and consciousness. So it's more than just a generalized figure. It's a meeting of at least two planes. A symbol, in other words, is a gateway to substance. It's a way to communicate it, but it's far more than just an abbreviation. Now, these kind of things are completely beyond the ken of nominalism. When I talk about the assumptions of the Enlightenment, and of course that's getting worse as far as, you know, post-modernity. Now, post-modernity is very hard to actually live. To be a consistent postmodernist is very difficult. I don't know how it can be done, because you really can't function as a unified self at all. But regardless, nominalism, the idea that there is no universal meanings to anything, connected with everything else we've dealt with, that there are no universals, there's no universal objects, everything is just a brute given that we, for the sake of pure utility, gather together in concepts and we give it a name. And it has no greater depth than that. But nominalism is false in Losev, because any time we utter something, it assumes the predicate has greater universality than the subject. A man is running. Running, of course, is extraordinarily universal. But man, of course, the subject, running is the predicate. Subject is a specific man. Running is a far broader conception, especially when you attach it to the idea of inherent purpose. They're running for a reason. Nothing happens without a reason. The hypostasis, as I mentioned before, talking about identity and idea, it's the connection of the essence of something and its appearance in front of us. It's a form as a concrete model. Now, we've dealt with Plato's forms before. Some people call them ideas or archetypes. You usually use a capital letter. I like the word form. That's just how I was taught. It just comes very naturally to me. You know, Losev lived in the Soviet Union, so he had to be very careful how he wrote and how he taught. He had numerous university appointments. He had to use a lot of the sloganeering of Leninism, but not serving its purpose. This is, unfortunately, the life that he led. Now, there is an idealist Christian dialectics. I have no problem with that. But the idea of Plato's form, the universal meaning in things, emerges dialectically from unity, from the one. One with a capital O, the very principle of unity. The origin of Logos, not Logos itself, its origin. Now, when you go to the university, many of you are listening to me because either you didn't go or you went and were manhandled there, intellectually and probably every other way. Philosophy 101 will start off by saying that the form in Plato is an abstraction. There's a heavenly justice as well as individual acts that are called just here on earth. They rarely get it right, though. And Losev spent quite a bit of time, I think it was in the 60s, he wrote fragments on Plato's forms. And he rejects most of the typical Western, including Heidegger's, unfortunately, conception of Plato's forms. Sometimes they go to some kind of sentimentality, mystical romanticism, some kind of Kantian transcendentalism. It's hard to interpret a classical writer from the point of view of an ideological modern. It's very difficult to view, say, a medieval writer, given the fact that we're born in the 20th century. It's very difficult to avoid imposing our biases onto them. And there's certainly very few in academia who are capable of it now. But that goes along with the mutilation of Plato's forms. The way that Losev puts it, it's really the bourgeois worldview. And of course, he's right about that. You know, that's an area that he could appeal to the Soviet mind. Of course, being fully aware that Leninism and Darwinian capitalism are very similar. It seems to put the one-sided interest of the subject, the person, the individual, the ego, as the primary concern. And this is something that Heidegger also spent a lot of time attacking. Of course, the classical writers, medievals, did not think in terms of the ego or the self as some isolated object, like Descartes would later, and Hobbes would later posit. But it is very difficult to understand a conception, a spiritual conception, and the forms are a spiritual conception, from the postmodern decay of the 21st century. And especially, in his case, 20th century Leninism. What Losev is trying to say is that in interpreting, say, Aristotle's four causes or Plato's forms, there either is a deliberate or indeliberate attempt to impose this materialist mechanization along with this isolated individual subject, with this unexplained thing called consciousness. And it's almost impossible to interpret anybody that way. I'm not sure how a liberal academic who hears nothing but his own ideology all day, who really has no access to anything but his own ideology all day, living in a city, living the most alienated life humanly possible, how such a person who's just distorted and mangled as it is can interpret someone like Thomas Aquinas or Augustine or Basil. They reduce them to modern slogans and just, you know, consider them as relics of the past. But they're in no position, psychologically or intellectually, to interpret any of this stuff. And Losev's one of the first people I read that made a point of this, talking about Plato or anyone else. For the most part, he was a classicist. Again, talking about, you know, Plato and Aristotle, Plotinus allowed him to bypass the Soviet censors. Something is also happening in certain parts of the Western world, too. No one is reducing Christianity to Platonism. That's an outrage. Plato made many errors. But it is, still, the forms are the intellectual scaffolding of how the church views metaphysics, especially when it comes to logos, where Plato's forms are all present. In the Kantian world, which is, you know, very much a modern conception, in the Kantian world, nothing really exists. Objects are only thought of. There are no givens. There's only principles of being. There's only methods. So someone like that is going to turn Plato's forms into some logical concept. Somehow they have to justify it relative to their modern biases. But of course, in the classical world, there was no conception of any of that. There was no transcendentalism. There was no absolute power of the subject or the ego. There was no absolute mechanism. The very foundation of interpreting these guys starts from nominalist distortion. These things, nominalism was not alien from the classical world. but it certainly is alien to Plato. So they begin interpreting someone like him and you know, the mangling that they do of the church fathers from the point of view of this egocentric mechanism or socialism. In the modern and postmodern world, postmodern, of course, is far worse. All of this is totally alien to the classical and early medieval philosophical idea. The classical idea, including the patristics, always proceeded from objective being, from specific objective beings, from the living body. That's the initial regulator of ancient philosophy, especially that which came from Plato and Aristotle. There was no manifestation of dualism or subjectivism. Trying to interpret him any other way removes him from the classical world. So you could start from the idea that the Platonic form is objective. It's an image of being. We don't have direct access to the forms. Now in Christ, Logos, the synthesis of all the forms, took human flesh, we did have access to it. Another reason why this, you know, epistemology is so important. Even though it's an image of being, it's a completely objective one. We can't talk about these abstractions or psychological theories, but being itself, objectively speaking, the unfolding of being with all of its, we could say, semantic content. There was no historicism in Plato's age, or even in the patristic age. Plato immerses these ideas in living, corporeal, and cosmic being. He didn't really go further than Parmenides or Pythagoras, or even Heraclitus. You can't really go further than that while remaining a Greek and you know, classical thinker. He interpreted the cosmos from the point of view of its ideal connections, dismembering the physical and elements of it. He identified it by meaning, the help of concepts. In other words, he identified it dialectically. Forms can't be understood through modern abstract metaphysics, assuming that metaphysics is even dealt with anymore. The very word idea, and we're talking about a capital I, and form and idea here are synonymous in this particular case. But Losev says the word idea has its root in the concept of appearance, an idea of what is visible in a thing. But when I say visible, we're not just talking about the eyes. We're talking about the intellect as well, which is where light comes in. Now, in Greek, it, according to Losev, that concept designates the external appearance of a thing, the appearance of a person, but not always. In Plato, the essence of an object, its being, its meaning, yeah, will be visible to the eye, as Christ was visible to the eye, but more importantly, was visible to the mind. The essence of a thing is something that's visible to the mind, the intellect. It's internal and external appearance. That's the idea of a thing. That's the form. The idea of a thing is not just a passive thing visible to the mind. It's also the very substance of the thing. The internal determining force, the principle. It's not just theoretical, but it's realized in itself, in its own ideal body. Without any of this, if this doesn't all happen at the same time, it wouldn't be being. It wouldn't be reality. It wouldn't even be useful. And certainly, you can't claim that it came from the classical world. Church fathers, of course, came directly from the classical world. I'm not even talking about the cosmic being, the integral all, the integral everything. Any object we see is inherently abstracted from the whole. So it's artificial to begin with, but given the nature of the fall and our limited intellects, we have no choice but to go from thing to thing. learning from the known to the unknown. So we talk about visibility. It's not merely a body that we can see with our eyes. Part of the revolutionary implications of the word taking flesh. I mean, really, you barely had any conception intellectually of that at the time. Or logos, in the sense that we define the term, the church defines the term. If logos can take fallen human flesh. Human flesh is ugly, it's gross, it rots. That's the assumption of the day, of course. But Losev goes farther. This is why he says that when Plato's talking about the forms, he's talking about a very different conception of gods, with a small g. He rationalized the pantheon. And it got him into a lot of trouble, as we know. Now, this is fairly abstract here. But let me put it like this. In Loth's mind, the Platonic form is not just a generalization. And that's normally how people are taught today. That's what the Platonic idea is. It's beyond that. It's a generalization beyond which the process of abstraction can't go. Can't go any further. In other words, it's closer, at least in Loth's mind, to mathematics. And it's able to give a more or less precise definition. Remember, numbers, especially in the classical world, can't be reduced to numerals. It's something, but it certainly is not a material thing. The Platonic form is the meaning, the essence, the definition of a thing. The very principle, the internal structure that makes it intelligible. Generating model. Everything, being itself, always means something that has its own essence. And the Platonic form is the principle of constructing this essence of any object, and hence the thing itself. Now, why am I going through all of this? Unfortunately, this has something to do with his very eccentric acceptance of the name worship idea. It's very difficult, especially the turn of the century Russia and early 20th century Russia, to separate that controversy from the explosion of the growth of Platonic studies there. And that's why this is sort of important. A form is not a generic essence. That's extremely crude. It's not a genus in relation to a species. The form is a structural function of a thing. Functional relations, tremendously complex. The idea was never conceived as some mental abstraction. Plato and his followers always introduce an aesthetic, an artistic element to it. The realm of ideas themselves, there was also a conception of ideal matter. And he hinted at it before in Timaeus. The paradigm, the model, the prototype. And on the one hand, the master, the artist, creator, the architect, or the material and the method of its processing. On the other hand, and that really didn't bother the Platonic movement at all. And remember, this isn't something that we accept as Christians necessarily. But it was the language and the foundation of patristic thinking. So you could point to geometric images, which, unlike numerals or numbers, are material in their manifestation, but geometric images don't possess any physical properties. And they are amenable to the most precise definition that any typical material formation is not subject to. So what's the point? There's a big distinction between the world of things and the world of ideas attached to the world of things. In other words, creation and its creator. There has to be, you know, if the whole comes before the parts, in other words, the part doesn't make any sense without the whole. That's how we started off, talking about the destructive nature of of modern postmodern science, then there has to be an ontological foundation for anything we do. Let me explain this in some more detail. The metaphysical structure that Losev is talking about is the foundation for the anti-materialist, anti-Darwinian mentality. It starts with the One. We could vaguely refer to this as God the Father in the sense that we can't talk about it. Even words like One with a capital O, this primordial unity, the foundation of foundations, the in itself. This is why a Phaphatic idea is so important, because the One really can't be talked about. Because any language, we have no experience with anything like this. We have experience with unity. One as the number one, a singularity, but not the foundation of that foundation. But the Word took flesh. The One didn't exist in isolation, as Aristotle had posited it. Now, being something that's for itself derives from it. It has to be manifested and then becoming. As Hegel and Kant would say, the synthesis of being and not being. Being contains a certain level of negation. But beyond that, I'm not talking about the Trinity here, I'm just using this as an example. But after becoming, you have substance. And then symbol, or its expression. Now, I mention all of this because this is how the dialectic works in terms of metaphysics. Instead of just the three things you see in Hegel, the presence, then its negation, then the synthesis of the two, you do have the initial three, the One, the in itself, and then being as its expression. The synthesis of those two is becoming. Substance is the essence. This is what we're really talking about with the form. Because the form is manifested, something that we can see. And because there is no random motion, substance, as we said before, provides the purpose. That's why we say it's for itself and for null. Substance is what comes after that very foundational three objects, the typical dialectic. It's what happens after that. Becoming, first of all, has to have a purpose. There has to be something you are becoming. And the change itself. And of course, as I said the last time, there has to be this thing that remains, that survives change. But as far as our practical life is concerned, the symbol is the expression. So now you have five things. And this is a variation of Plato's Parmenides. Losev took the typical dialectic of Hegel and added two more things, and which is not necessarily something that Hegel would have rejected. Now, what's the payoff of all of this? We've dealt with these issues before with Hegel. We've done it with many Christian metaphysicians in the past. One of the things that Losev used to confront the Soviet system and certainly the capitalist and bourgeois system is his idea of myth. Myth fits the symbol, or the substance and the symbol, and the scheme above. Now, he defines myth very differently. When the term is abused as it is, myth isn't something false. Now, normally I use the word myth, I mean something that's true in essence, but fictional in detail. Losev goes much further with it. The concept of myth is the payoff for all the abstractions, all the very difficult stuff that I've just dealt with. Myth is its social manifestation. It's the personality, the presence of the holistic. It's the ground for all human action and human identity. It's something along the lines of Heidegger's design. It's the social development of consciousness. Myth is the background, the meta reality that informs all of our actions, our personality. But in and of itself, it has a personality. It may have false elements, but he spent a lot of time talking about myth as the ultimate metaphysical object, at least relative to us. The myth is that third thing that links the word and its meaning, the link between the object and its idea. It's organic, it's historic, it's also personal, and it has a personality in and of itself. And we don't have any proof. Any phenomenon, any sensation is purely subjective. We see something with our eyes. We can't prove that that exists to ourselves. People like Berkeley have, during the Enlightenment, made a point of that. Like Hume say, we've never seen a cause before. There's no proof of that. But the myth is where the subject and the object are the same. It's intuition. It's a pre-logical, pre-rational intuition. It's that upon which reason and logic take their start. It implies a historical unfolding. It's our social manifestation of the absolute. It's static and ideal, which is the power vertical, dynamic and the hypostasis, the power horizontal. Idea connected with matter creates the symbol, the essence, and its image. All of this is understood and comes into being because of the myth within which we live. And this is something that he used, something along the lines of Vogelin's cosmion. In the feudal era, the Middle Ages, both in Russia and elsewhere, the spirit is made absolute. Its conquest by capital makes humanity relative. And he sees socialism. Now, he says this given his, he lives in the Soviet Union, but he sees socialism as the final synthesis, spirit and matter in production. Authority plus subjectivism, urban capitalism, create socialism. Now, in his mind, he's talking about the idealistic conception of social life. He's not talking about Leninism. And most of the people, especially near the end of his life, who read him were well aware of it. Socialism has its materialist and globalist ideology, Leninism. But it also has its idealistic and Christian side. And at an absolute minimum, he sees the Soviet Union as the antithesis of what socialism is supposed to be, as I've written many times, and have quote after quote after quote and policy after policy that I've described. The Soviet Union had nothing to do with labor, with workers, with peasants. Those were abstractions. In the language that we've been talking about, there is no form. It's simply the invention of language. It's simply the manifestation of power. It has no connection with anything. Socialism was about enriching a very small group of people, destroying Christianity, destroying the church, and destroying metaphysics. It had absolutely nothing to do with who produced what. But the foundation of myth for him is dialectical. For him, it's a logical construction. It differs from the philosophies that place the center of gravity in the moods and feelings of the philosopher, who sees the world through a very specific perspective. It's a way of philosophizing within the framework of which thinkers try to renounce the purely subjective component of logic, which of course is almost impossible to realize in practice. It's very difficult to remove the subjective component to any kind of cognition. We could say the same for theology. Reason, intellect, is very different from formal logic. The real sphere of logic is the physical world and its application, other areas. And that application is always going to be incomplete and insufficient. But even the mind by itself is not a self-sufficient instance whatsoever. It is, however, closely interconnected within the framework of the cognitive process, which has its foundation in the heart. Logic, then, is the construction of objects that we understand from initial elements, elements that don't possess any specific content. Dialectics, in other words, is occupied with the logical construction of something, but the nature of the thing is irrelevant. It's the opposite to, you know, an intimate attitude towards a thing. Logical construction is a specific and a very empty aspect of the object. You know, being, non-being, limit, unlimited, these are ultimately empty when seen from the logical point of view. Dialectics is a very different kind of approach. Let me put it like this. Any object, any X that we come across, is inherently infinite, no matter how small or minor it is, because it's capable of infinite application or connections. It could be seen from an infinite number of points of view. So anytime we talk about a definition or an attribute, it's inherently isolated from this huge infinite background. It's a little bit like attributes in Spinoza's system. So the definition of something in that context is the comparison of it as it goes through change. The essence and hence our understanding of an object becomes richer as it is brought into other areas of life. In other words, dialectics rejects the idea of something as fixed. It's certainly objective, but it's also something that develops in history. So as John of Damascus would say, the concept of hypostasis is both a metaphysical thing, being, as well as its individual presence. When the Trinity became an object of contention, it forced the intellectual world into a dialectical frame of mind because it had to deal with the unity of opposites. In other words, the knowledge became only of the whole, of the process. The world itself is a mediator. It's part of our trek, our struggle towards the truth. The constant battle is the idea of X on the one hand versus the object itself on the other hand. And whenever we talk about subjectivism, our relative status, it refers to objects apart from its form, apart from logos. The way Losef understands it, you know, dialectics uses names and words to abbreviate a much larger reality. Now, nominalism takes that abbreviation as the thing itself. It comes from this urban, middle-class, bourgeois society, really more of a protest than any kind of lasting doctrine. It's logic that's divorced from ontology, from existence. Without ontology, words depend on subjective meaning, whatever the powerful are able to convince you is the meaning and purpose of something. Sophistry depends on it. Tyranny depends on it. But as I said before, you can't consistently live that life, postmodern or otherwise. Nominalism, it's like liberalism. It lives parasitically on older conceptions of morality that it requires to function, as it's destroying it. And I use the word parasitically very carefully. You can't talk about an object in front of me without talking about its essence, its form, or substance. Even the founder of modern or late medieval nominalism, William of Ockham, said, yes, forms exist, universals exist, but they exist only in God and logos, and hence they're totally unknown to us. But that also implies that God and man are not connected, which means that only God's will, his power, is the only thing that matters. X is the right thing to do because God says so. It has nothing to do with who we are as human beings or natural law or anything. The point of this whole issue is that there has to be a ontological connection between our intellect, our process of cognition, and the divine. Plato's forms are found in logos, the second person, or the being of God as it is understood by us, to the extent that Christ has revealed it. There's a definition of God that's radically separate from it, his reality. But the former is as far as the mind can reach. To reject this commensurability between man and God, all you have is dogmatic definitions, not God himself. It closes off the mind. Words like word, name, in the sense we've been using it, it refers to all of this mythic manifestation, mythic in Losev's sense, art, iconography, music, vestments, incense, embroidery, even climates and calendar developments. They're words in the sense that they're all symbols that use material and contingent entities to express elements of absolute and unchanging significance. I know it took us a long time to get there, but that's what we're talking about. Now, words are always contingent. They're necessary because we need to communicate with another, usually badly. The concept of a word or a name uses material things, contingent things, to express absolute things. But because we live in an anomalist and now even post-anomalist world, the use of words is now just a form of manipulation rather than as a means of expressing truth. Once that assumption is built in to how people think, it destroys all knowledge because being of things is not commensurate with our cognition. Reason just can't be something that exists in our soul. It has to exist in the macrocosm too. That's how we come to know something. The anomalous idea really is meant to break down cultures or understandings, design, the purpose of implanting a new order in its place. Because there is no universal mind anomalism. It's just words. Words like grace, for example, can't refer to anything since there's nothing that exists universally. I've talked about, for the John Romanidis, this agnosticism, that human beings cannot know God and can't love him because there's no commensurability. Unless there's a basis, a foundation for a connection between God and man, there can be no such thing as prayer. All there is power. Nominalism in the church argues that there's no similarity between the uncreated and the created. They have nothing in common, or between God and creation, including things like correlation or comparison. They have nothing in common. So what it comes down to is that we can't use, in that mentality, created things as a means of coming to know the uncreated God. I've talked about this in the past, but that is the essence of modernity as it applies to theology. If there is no commensurability, no similarity between God and his creation, then what does image and likeness mean in the book of Genesis? It's precisely this likeness, this commensurability between God and man. That's the basis of the union. That's the foundation of man's deification. I mean, how could you even talk about that without commensurability? What it comes down to is that words and concepts have come into existence because they're useful, not because they refer to anything real. Put differently, Christ, Logos, taking flesh, containing Logos, you know, the world in its fullness of absolute truth in himself, brought this directly to anyone. You don't have to be a philosopher here. Christ obviated the need to be a philosopher to gain the highest of truths, which is something that Plato failed to do. Christ carried this truth within himself and made it accessible. To a great extent, this is the purpose of myth, of design. We have access to truths that we may not subjectively understand, but it informs all of our actions. Doesn't obviate freedom, but it informs all of our actions. This is design. This is the fundamental meta background understanding of all of our actions. It's beyond culture, but it is a thing. It is a historic thing. We live in an age of unprecedented corruption, but that corruption implies that there is a higher standard. We live in an age where words don't really have meaning. They only have meaning if they refer to a universal entity. A fact doesn't exist by itself. It needs to be a part of the forms. They only have meaning when all the terms are defined. Facts only have meaning when it's a part of a structure of reason. Corruption forces us to transcend that which is all around us. The idea and the object, they're not the same. The fact and the idea are not the same. And the worse the corruption, the deeper we have to penetrate into the concept of the one, which has its manifestation in Logos, and its presence in a variation of Christian culture we may call the mythic structure of our lives. I know this has been a very difficult, very off-putting discussion. It makes more sense if you've connected it to other things that I've done, but Losef is not an easy writer. I think many of you see the deeper understanding here and how important Plato and Plotinus are to the Christian understanding. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.